Hi, this is Amanda from the LIO calling in for a sound check.
Thanks, Amanda. Testing.
Sounds good.
Testing.
Also good.
Testing.
Yep. Sounds good.
Testing.
Yep, that one sounds good too.
Testing.
Sounds good.
Testing.
Yep, sounds good.
Testing.
Good.
Testing.
Yep, that one's a little quiet, but it sounds clear.
Thank you. Testing.
Ooh, that one's a little bit loud.
And testing.
Also louder.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Have a good meeting.
Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time's 9 a.m., February 31st, 2023. With me today is Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Olson, Senator Merrick, Senator Keel. The other two senators will probably be joining us a little later. On the agenda today, we're going to go over questions that the committee had with three departments, Natural Resources, Revenue, and the Office of Management and Budget. Rather than just have, as normal, the questions responded to from the committee in writing, we thought it'd be easier for the public to actually see the answers if we brought the folks back and we kind of went over the questions and went into maybe a little bit more detail on some stuff. Some items here today are kind of prelude to upcoming presentations, so we'll kind of mention that when that time comes. So this isn't the end-all, be-all for it, but it's, you know, part of setting the stage. We've been joined by Senator Bishop also. So I'd like to start with the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Gowther, Deputy Commissioner, come forward. Jump in the chair. It says here in my script that you have lifelines, but we don't know if we're going to offer you any. We have faith that you can answer the questions and take us through the written responses from the department. Red?
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is John Crowther. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Very pleased to be here this morning to provide some follow-up information to the committee and, as you said, sir, hopefully address your questions, but I may depend on my lifelines just yet. I guess I'll jump right in. I believe the Department of Revenue did prepare a slide presentation. The Department of Natural Resources just responded via a letter to the committee with some of the questions that were asked in our production forecast hearing, where we shared the department's official estimations of forthcoming oil production over the next 10 years. So if it's all right with you, Chair Stedman, I'll just begin speaking to the questions as they appear in our letter. And of course, any further questions that the committee may have, be happy to respond or follow up with additional information. So the first topic, our letter dated January 26th that I believe the committee is in receipt of, the first topic we spoke to is regards capital expenditures, upcoming and expected capital expenditures on the North Slope. And I won't speak to this in too much detail, primarily because the Department of Revenue, I believe, is going to present some very detailed information for you that really directly answers the question in a both graphical and narrative way. But I did want to share just a few examples of public information about capital expenditures to contextualize the issue for the committee. The first is that the Department of Revenue in their revenue sources book for fiscal year 2022 has noted that allowable capital expenditure was $1.4 billion. Future capital expenditures for the next two fiscal years from the revenue sources book as well are $2.3 billion and $2.7 billion respectively. And then some public-facing information just from corporate announcements, other media reports to share about capital outlook on the slope. The PICA project, Santos, the operator of that project, has identified a $2.6 billion capital expenditure to bring that project forward. And similarly for Willow, the Willow project, ConocoPhillips, the operator, has identified a cost of about $8 billion. In that description by the operator, they have not identified capital versus operating expenditures. However, in the Federal Environmental Review associated with the Willow project, there's been analysis or a little bit more breakdown of those figures by a consultant for the Bureau of Land Management in the course of preparing that review. And so they indicated drilling expenditures just under $4 billion, facilities expenditures between $4 billion and $5 billion, and a little bit above that, and that operating expenditures would range from $4 billion to $4.9 billion. And that's sourced from those Federal Environmental Review documents. And then just two final points for the committee on that question of capital expenditure and the outlook. ConocoPhillips has made public descriptions that they have a capital expenditure plan over the next 10 or so years in the order of $20 to $25 billion, very significant. And I understand that to be in addition to the Willow project. So that's all sorts of capital activity on the North Slope. And we have not seen breakouts of the three projects that the department mentioned as, you know, forthcoming significant projects on the slope, in the Colville River unit, in the Milley Point unit, by Operator Hillcorp, or the Kuparuk River unit. But I think it's fair to say within that $20 to $25 billion ConocoPhillips capital spend, that's Colville River unit project and KRU project would likely be included in that. So I hope that provides the committee a little bit of context. In short summary, we really see a robust capital deployment plan on the North Slope in our current kind of expectations. But the Department of Revenue will speak to their forecasted numbers for that in greater detail with some good slides. So if there's no further questions from the committee, I'd move to the next topic, sir.
Senator Wilson has arrived. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Good morning, sir. Thanks for coming. The Willow project, the drilling plan, that's over the life of the project, the $4.5 billion spend?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, it's my understanding that is a holistic assessment of the project life in the course of the environmental review. So it might extend further than the 10-year window, but I'm not off the top of my head sure exactly the kind of considerations their consultant utilized.
Thank you.
And can you go over again the royalty, how that is produced and how it's split?
Yeah, Chair Stedman. So the Willow project is in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, federal lands. To the west of the Prudhoe Bay unit and other longtime state operating assets. So for that development on federal lands, the royalty percentage is allocated 50% between the federal government, goes to the general federal treasury, and 50% goes to the state of Alaska, but it's allocated to the Community Impact Assistance Fund, primarily under current state and federal law. And in that fund, those revenues that are deposited there go through the legislature and go through a grant application project that local communities and identified communities on the North Slope can apply for grants to support their communities and respond to the impacts that they see associated with the development. So that's the current allocation of those royalties.
Right, and my understanding is there is no cash flow into the treasury itself. It's basically passed through, and the impacted communities apply for grants that normally exceed the royalty, the 50% royalty, and we get a report every year. Is that correct?
That's my current understanding, Senator Stedman, is that historically there have not been significant revenues in that impact mitigation fund, and so in certain years the applications for grants have exceeded the availability of funds. It's certainly anticipated, and we've already started to see with production in the Greater Moose's Tooth unit that an increasing amount of funds on a regular basis are going into that Community Impact Assistance Fund. And so certainly if the Willow project started up, the amount of funds in that account would be significantly higher than historical numbers.
Right, and the reason I bring this up is just there was some confusion over a previous meeting on the cash flow to the general fund, to the state, and there's a 50% reduction or 50% sharing with the royalties on the federal, but that 50% that the state gets doesn't end up in the state coffers, and we all understand that at the table, just because we've had some questions and comments sent into Senate offices for an explanation or clarifying that. So we look forward to that report. I think it's already in. I saw a previous one here a few days ago with the grants. We normally include those in the budgets. And Senator Olson always takes a particular interest in that, actually being a senator from the region, and we would expect that. So we look forward to seeing those those items in the budget this year.
Absolutely, sir.
So we'll go to the next. Any other questions before we go to the next one? Okay, next question.
Thank you, Chair Chisabman. So on page 2 of our letter, the next topic is the Smith Bay unit, Smith Bay development status. We included as in our responsive letter as an attachment a communication from the Smith Bay Company, the current owner and operator of that the leases in that vicinity, that has applied for a unitization and potential drilling plan of those areas. So, and historically there have been two wells drilled in the Smith Bay kind of block or prospect. And those wells, as I currently understand, were not fully tested, but that their assessment continues by the Smith Bay Company.
Any questions, Senator Bishop?
Thank you. That was previously, I think, Kalis that drilled those wells. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, John. So did they sell and we've got a new company? And can you expound on that?
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Through the chair, the current operator is identified as the Smith Bay Company. I believe there have been some transactions affecting the ownership and control of the corporate entities managing that prospect. But I think we'd like to make sure we represent that accurately, both for the committee and the public. So
thank you.
Happy to follow up.
And if you can get back to us on that, because Smith Bay is just a bay, so somebody went together and cooked up the name. So yeah, it would be nice for clarifying on that. Any other questions on Smith Bay? Go to the next question, please.
Yeah, thank you, sir. So on page 2, we have a response a little bit about confidential information. So I wanted to frame, there's a couple different areas, general areas where the department addresses confidential information, to share a brief overview with the committee. The first is our under existing law, AS 3805-035, particularly 035 subsection A8, details certain criteria that companies and individuals can share information with the department, and if it is consistent with the terms identified in the statute, is maintained as confidential. We understand the primary rationale of that statute is to allow companies to share sensitive commercial and geologic data with the department in the course of business and operations they're required to conduct with the department. So for us to do the best job we can, but without that information becoming public and damaging both their corporate plans and the kind of broader reputation of the state for being open for investment. And that statute is a longstanding provision that's been in place and the department has managed for an extended period. To further provide information for the committee, the historically tax credits that were enacted by the legislature and a variety of companies were eligible for also had periods that the data generated by the activities that generated the tax credit had to be transferred to the state and were kept confidential for a set period of time between 2 and 10 years, according to the kind of information that it was. And at the end of that period, that information was released. Many of those pieces of information have been released by the department because that statutory time period has elapsed. There are other pieces of information that period will be elapsing this year and in the coming years, and the department's proceeding to make that information public consistent with the law. Sometimes it's very complex data that requires some degree of processing and internal analysis to make it publicly accessible in a meaningful way as opposed to raw data. And so there's some time period lag, unfortunately, between when that period statutorily expires and when it may, for lack of a better way of saying it, show up on the website. But we're working as expeditiously as we can to fulfill those timelines and make that data public. And then I would just note one other additional piece of information for the committee. When wells are drilled in the state of Alaska, as a general matter, they're required to disclose the information associated with those wells to the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, which is kept confidential for a short period of time, at the fullest extent 2 years after the completion for exploration wells. And that there's limited circumstances under law when a developer can apply for extended confidentiality, and the department reviews those for consistency with the statutory and regulatory criteria. And if they don't meet them, then the data becomes public. If they do meet them, the department may grant, in limited circumstances, extended confidentiality for certain wells.
Any questions on this? I've got one kind of a comment. One of the concerns that's been expressed at the table many, many times by myself and some of my colleagues is when we're dealing with the public purse, it is, in fact, public money, and they deserve the right to know what's going on with their funds and their expenditures. And the way we have our system structured, as an example, we can have billions of credits going in and expenditures going into, for instance, Point Thompson, yet we can't have the data on the table to see if the decisions we made were actually good decisions for the state or less than ideal decisions for the state as far as profitability goes. And in this case, we're dealing with billions of dollars, not hundreds of millions. And I personally think that the public has a right to know what happens to their money. And I think the disclosure rules here need to be modified at some point in time so the public could see what's going on with their funds, and if the industry doesn't want to use their funds, or the state funds, that's fine. They don't have to. We've changed those credit laws now, stripped a lot of them out. But it's just something for future legislators to keep in mind in the event that the credit discussion ever circles around and comes back, because it is the public purse. And I have a hard time accepting the fact that we could have billions into a particular investment and we can't see the results of it. And we can estimate them because the industry has helped us do that. So we have a pretty good idea of what's going on, but we should have more than just a pretty good idea. And I recognize that the statutes block that and take a statute change. So I recognize we do this to ourselves, per se. It's just something that I think we need to not replicate in the future. So, on disclosure, some basins disclose virtually everything, and the world doesn't end in those basins. So I think there's more to the story than having the competitor know what's going on. But anyway, we'll go on to the next question.
Thank you, Chair Stebbin. And I believe we just have two more responsive points to share with the committee. The first is quite quick. I believe there was a request to characterize the cumulative volume of future North Slope projects in the under-evaluation category. In our 10-year forecast, if you may recall the visual, and apologies, I don't have it here to display, this was the gray bar at the end of the presentation for projects that have been identified by operators as coming online in the next 10-year period. The department does an assessment of the likely contribution of those projects over time. And so the sum of that volume wedge integrated over the 10-year period is approximately 530 million stock tank barrels of oil over 10 years. And so, to contextualize that information, I believe Prudhoe Bay and the broader North Slope has produced over 18 billion barrels of oil to date. So in our next 10-year period, we would see a contribution of over 500 million barrels to that, bringing us much closer, possibly exceeding 19 billion barrels of cumulative oil produced to date. And Chair, if you or no other members have questions there, I would proceed to our last point.
Any questions, Senator Olson?
I guess the question I have is that just from the Prudhoe Bay well itself, for the 19 billion?
No, Senator. Through the chair, the under-evaluation wedge is meant to capture all projects, so that would include additional development drilling in existing fields like Prudhoe Bay, potentially new satellite pads or infield developments, but also entirely new projects, potentially like Pika, Willow, or other potential development.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions on this one before we go to capacity utilization or capacity status? Okay, go ahead and take us through this paragraph, please, or several paragraphs.
Yes, Chair. So this point, I would refer the committee. This is our response is on page 3, but we also included an attachment, a spreadsheet attachment that extends through pages 7 through the end of our letter that depicts the facility processing capacity at a variety of units on the North Slope. We provided this information to show, you know, we discussed in our presentation that many facilities and units on the North Slope are processing capacity constrained, meaning that the ability of that unit to handle either water or produced gas in the appropriate way is actually one of the limitations on the amount of oil that's produced from that area. And so our team went through the publicly available information from the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, or AOGCC, to both see historical production, facility capacity, and facility utilization rates. I just want to provide a disclaimer for the committee that as this information is public, it and is based on historical rates, peak rates, and is not the actual real-time operating numbers. The operators may have identified different limitations on their facilities that are not readily ascertainable from this public data. But I think our team believes, based on their engineering expertise and experience, that these are very good reference points for the committee and the public to understand this issue of processing capacity limitation. And I would just note if it's all right with the committee, I'll go through the slide just to identify a couple points that I believe are relevant for understanding it most fully. When you turn to it, you see as laid out, and I apologize, we're not presenting this via slide for ease of access. But in the letter attachment, you can see across the top the kind of categories of information. There's the particular units. So those are familiar names, Kuparuk River, KRU, Prudhoe Bay, PBU. There's the facility. And so that's the specific facilities within the unit. As reference, for instance, in the Kuparuk River unit, we have in a grouped and aggregated fashion the KRU Central Processing Facility, or CPF 1, 2, and 3.
Let's try not to use acronyms. No one will even know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So we got to make sure the people at home understand what we're discussing here.
Thank you, sir. Apologies. That's the Central Production Facility. The acronym I use, CPF, Central Production Facility. The next column is oil capacity. And so that's the oil produced in that field or unit in the 2022, the last year. And then the capacity of those facilities is assessed by our folks. In some of those fields, the capacity for oil is not assessed. There's a question mark. In others, based on publicly available information, there is an estimate by the department. The next column is the gas capacity. And so that's the ability of the facilities within the unit to handle gas that's produced in the course of the development and to manage it. Does it need to be treated, dehydrated, pressurized, reinjected? And so that those facilities perform those functions. And you can see in the table, for instance, in the Prudhoe Bay field, that the estimation of the capacity of those facilities to process that gas is 8.5 million thousand cubic feet per day. And then we look at the right below that, the average rate we saw in 2022, and see a performance of 7.8 million cubic feet per day. So in my non-technical estimation, quite close to the identified capacity. And I would just note for the committee's understanding, I'm not a licensed or engineer, don't have that technical skill set. But it's my understanding from communicating with the experts in the department that you wouldn't want to run these facilities, you wouldn't want to run these facilities at their capacity because you need to maintain a buffer. There's high flow days, there's low flow days, there's ambient temperature. There's a variety of things that affect the engineering performance of these facilities. And so you'd absolutely want to maintain some additional capacity. And so it's fair to represent that 7.8 million out of 8.5 million is a very high utilization rate. And that's why we talk about these facilities being constrained by the processing capacity. Chair Stedman, as you noted in our presentation, is that when you have that facility limitation, it's something you have to pay very close attention to in the course of your operations.
So if we were to go from 500,000 barrels a day to 1 million barrels a day, wouldn't that be rather impossible with these constraints without changing the mix of oil and gas or oil and water?
Chair Stedman, I don't mean to oversimplify to too great a degree, but I believe there's a variety of things. So, you know, the operators with current facilities are working very hard to optimize them to increase the production and uptime of current operations. It's certainly possible for the producers and developers to make additional capital improvements to expand existing facilities or add additional facilities. And we see both the Pikka project and the Willow project contemplating additional processing facilities as part of their development that would enable, in a sense, their raw or crude oil production to be appropriately processed, both with, you know, gas and water management and then the oil itself, and then shipped ultimately to the Trans-Alaska pipeline. So it is fair to say that our existing facilities would constrain our oil production from expanding to a significant degree, but the possible addition of new facilities would enable that.
Right, because the mix would change.
That's right, sir.
Between oil and gas and oil and water. So for those at home, maybe you can just run down roughly the facility limitations. It would be easier than for them to grasp, for instance, Prudhoe Bay or Top One. What's its issue?
Certainly, sir. So I'll just run through that final column, the facilities limits, with a couple additional notes. So for the Prudhoe Bay field, both gas and water are constrained. And I don't mean to exceed my capacity, but the operations of managing both gas and water at a field as complex as Prudhoe Bay are very significant. And so when we talk about water management, there's a variety of steps, each one of which could be constrained or limited by different things. So I don't, but just for sake of oversimplifying for the public, I think it's fair to say that both gas and water are restrictions at Prudhoe Bay.
And is not the operator at Prudhoe Bay enhancing the processing facilities, thereby increasing its flow of oil?
That's correct, Chair Stedman. Since the Hillcore operations have begun at Prudhoe Bay, I think they've invested significant efforts into understanding and optimizing the processing for both gas and water. And that's resulted in an actual slight increase in the Prudhoe Bay unit, I believe, 1 year ago. And, you know, for a field of that maturity with that level of life in service of those assets, we at the department viewed as a very significant accomplishment.
Right. And we should call them out and give them credit for that because we see it in the production.
That's absolutely correct, sir.
Mm-hmm. If we can run down the rest of them, please, fairly quick.
Absolutely. So the Prudhoe Bay Greater Point McIntyre, so essentially a Prudhoe Bay satellite, very similar issues there, both gas and water constrained. The Milne Point unit, as you can see in the table, is water constrained primarily, but the gas processing capacity there, also significant demand on that. The Kuparuk River unit, is less gas constrained than Prudhoe Bay, to be sure, and water processing capacity is the primary restriction on those flow rates. Moving on to page 8 of our letter and the Point Thompson field, a very different kind of development concept than those traditional fields, but the nature of that project essentially means it's fundamentally gas constrained. It's the production of natural gas. It's called a gas condensate reservoir, and the fluids that are shipped into ultimately the Trans-Alaska pipeline, natural gas liquids and condensates. So the ability to process that gas as it comes up, repressurize it to the tremendously high pressure of the field and reinject it is the limiting factor there. Moving to the Badami facility, Letter and communication indicates that it's gas constrained, and for further explanation for the committee, I believe that is, were that facility to reach kind of the anticipated uptimes for design, it would become gas constrained. Unfortunately, at the moment, the Badami processing facility is not seeing much throughput and utilization, but we understand the operator of that facility is making efforts to potentially reassess and increase uptime of the wells within it and potentially expand their operations to see greater utilization of that facility. Moving to the final two items on page 8, that's the Duck Island or Endicott facility and unit, and then the Nakayachuk. Both of those, while the operator has not identified constraints, both of those fields, due to their just general operational parameters, it's fair to say both gas and water management is certainly relevant and is to their operations, in part due to the age of those facilities. The oil throughput you see in the chart, particularly for the Endicott facility, the oil throughput, 6,000 barrels per day, is significantly lower than the capacity for oil, but the gas and water management capacity is much closer to the identified limits. And that's, you know, the age of an oil field advances, the amount of oil that's recovered declines, but that doesn't necessarily hold true for other fluids in the reservoir that continue to be produced and cycled and reinjected. Moving on to the final page, page 9, we have three items here. The first is the North Star unit, the second is Oguric, and the third is Colville River, or the CRU. For the North Star facility, similar to my point above, the operator has not identified constraints, but the oil throughput relative to the capacity is low, while the gas and water ratios are relatively high. Again, owing to the age of the facility and field. For Oguric, we see a facility that is while it is does have some constraints, it is operating below capacity. And then for the Colville River unit, we see that they both gas and water capacity, but more so gas capacity, drive the operations there.
Any questions on this before we let him off the hook? Okay, I'd like to thank the department for coming forward. And just as a brief heads up, we have a lot of new members in the building and then the public watching, of course. And these hearings are more for the public than for the committee, frankly. It'd be nice when the presentations are given in the other body that you run down this issue with the other body. To help the new members understand there's a lot more to it than just the pipe being at 500,000 barrels a day. You've got all the cycling and you're being in Kaparik, drowned in water, almost a water company, extracting oil, and then in Prudhoe dealing with the gas and reinjection. It just helps, I think, the understanding of what we're dealing with, and because we all want more production, including the industry and us.
Thank you, Senator. Very, very well said, and we will endeavor to do so.
Yeah. Okay. We'll have a brief at ease while we set up the Department of Revenue. We're at ease. We'll come back to order here, some resemblance of order, and we'll have the Department of Revenue come forward, please. Commissioner designee. We've been waiting for days to come back before the committee again. Welcome, Commissioner designee, Mr. Adam Crum, and I see you have your trustee aide, Mr. Stickle, the chief economist, with you. So if you could take us through the questions, and we'll probably have some other ones, I would imagine, because of the subject matter. And for those watching at home, we'll be having the department back many times between now and May, talking about some of these issues. So we're just trying to, again, lay the groundwork to start doing some budgetary analysis to figure out how we're going to deal with the potential $400 to $500 million. So with that, Mr. Crum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Adam Crum, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. As we start off, we're going to go with the Tax Division first. I just want the members to know that one of the first questions in writing for the Tax Division is actually something that the Treasury Division will answer after Mr. Stickle is done. And so Mr. Stickle has put together a slideshow to go over the questions that the committee sent.
Yeah. Awesome. For the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with Department of Revenue. So beginning with slide two, we were asked to restate the slide in our presentation last week that looked at the percent of market value transfer from the permanent fund and the 10-year forecast for that, and to restate that adjusted for inflation. So what we've done here on slide two is we've provided a second line looking at the percent of market value transfer forecast in real 2023 dollars, and we've applied an assumed 2.25% inflation rate for fiscal year 2024 and beyond, and then we've incorporated the actual inflation rate to adjust the fiscal year 2022 transfer.
Okay. So we see a lowering of the actual purchasing power.
So we see, Mr. Chairman, that if you look at this in real terms, the percent of market value transfer would be fairly stable, whereas in nominal terms, we do see it increasing over time.
Stable or flat, we prefer increasing because our expenditures seem to always go up. Go ahead, continue.
And slide three is another iteration of that percent of market value transfer slide. We were asked by the committee to present a high and a low case for that transfer. What we've done here is we've taken the forecasted distribution of potential returns provided by Callan Associates, which is the investment consultant to the Permanent Fund Corporation, and we've run those through a statistical analysis and generated a 90th and 10th percentile for potential transfers to the general fund. You can see that in the low case, we'd have a flat transfer in nominal terms, and then in the high case we'd have the transfer growing even more so than in the official forecast. That said, it's still a fairly stable revenue source compared to the potential volatility from, say, oil revenues.
Can you help the committee why there's no divergence starting in FY24? Doesn't start till FY25?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. So the percent of market value transfer calculation is based on the ending balance of the permanent fund in the first five of the last six fiscal years. What that does is, by using a five-year average, it provides stability to the transfer and helps filter out some of the volatility if there's a large swing in investment earnings from one year to the next. By using the first five of the last six fiscal years for the calculation, it means that in the first fiscal year, in this case, fiscal year 2024, we already know with certainty what the transfer will be. And so it's fiscal year 2025 and beyond that you start to see any impacts of higher or lower investment returns compared to the forecast. And looking at the slide here, there is a slight difference between the various lines in fiscal year 2025. It's a very small difference between high case and low case, and really It's once you start seeing the compounding impacts of higher or lower investment returns that you see the wider divergence between the blue and the red lines.
Any questions on this? It's an important concept to remind ourselves of is the predictability when we do our budget. It's a known number. It's roughly half of our revenue, ballpark, a little less than that, 46% of it or so, versus the oil taxes and oil revenue, I should say, and other revenue, which is probably down around 6% total. So it gives us a lot of predictability and stability within our budget process. Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Can you explain a little bit more on why the low case looks higher than the official forecast in the previous slide? Just slightly.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, so comparing slide 2 and slide 3, I would point out there's a so slide 2 is looking at, in the red line is the official forecast in nominal terms. The blue line is the official forecast in real terms. The official forecast in nominal terms from slide 2 should align with the official forecast in nominal terms from slide 3.
Pretty close. Yeah, so I guess the question then is if you had the inflation adjusted, the difference should be similar in the representation on the slide if that was added.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, and we'll be happy to take another look at that. See if there's any other nuance that I should have.
That's fine. You can do that. It'll help the committee a little bit. We're going to do a lot of sensitivity analysis on our revenue stream. So over the next 3 or 4 years, 5 or 6 years probably. Okay, we'll go on to slide 4.
Sure.
We have a question on slide 3.
Just a comment. It'd be interesting, Mr. Chairman, to see what this slide would look like if we hadn't put another $9 billion into the corpus.
I mean, if we... Yeah, okay. Go ahead and go on to slide 4.
Right, moving on, slide 4. So we had presented in our presentation last week a slide that showed... the history of Alaska North Slope oil prices since 2019, as well as our forecast for Alaska North Slope oil prices, and compared the forecast to several different sources of oil price outlook. And the request was to restate this slide looking at historical futures market outlooks as well. And so that's what you see here on slide 4, as we've shown the futures market outlook for Brent oil prices, and we took that from around the end of December, beginning of January of each fiscal year. The idea was to look at what was the futures market saying at about this time in the legislative session each year since 2019 and compare that to the current revenue forecast. And what you can see is that the near term for the futures market really tends to move with near-term oil prices, so there's a lot of volatility there. Once you get out into the later years, there's still volatility in what the futures market is saying, but the range of those prices is a little bit less of a range once you get further out in the futures curve than in the very near term. And kind of looking in this consistently looking in this range of somewhere between $50 and $80 for a longer-term oil price.
Okay, we have any questions or comments? The reason I asked for this chart to be presented is some folks get zeroed in on the future price at any given time as an accurate predictor of the future price. And we can see here that doesn't really work. You can take a look at the price range of FY23 here. Or 23, I should say, in the difference between $100 and basically $50. So we've got to give that some consideration when we try to figure out how not to run out of cash between now and year 4 or 5. We know we're done in year 10. We can't get there. So we'll work with the future markets when you do your presentations and stuff, but take them with a grain of salt, because 6 months later, the numbers are going to move around. And 6 months from that, it'll move around some more. So.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, we view the futures market as being one of the best representations of a most likely case, but it is within a wide range of outcomes. We acknowledge that oil prices are volatile, and we have a couple of slides coming up in the responses that will address that in more detail.
Okay, and just I would like to also note here on this slide that from the information we get at the committee quite often from the finance arena, is they want to see the industry profitable at $60, which is, you know, reflected here, where $60 is, and we're up in the low 80s. So I know that's not your issue, it's the finance committee's issue, but it is a scary spread. So we'll go on to page five.
Sure. So slide five takes the oil price forecasts that we had presented in the chart last week, comparing our fall forecast to the futures market outlook at the time, as well as an average forecast from industry analysts and the short-term energy outlook from the Energy Information Agency, and just provides the exact numerics that went into the slide from last week.
Okay. Any questions on this one? Okay, next slide.
Slide six is our chart showing the sensitivity of unrestricted general fund revenue relative to oil price. So this chart shows fiscal year 2024 unrestricted general fund revenue, excluding that percent of market value transfer, and how that would change if oil prices did not come in exactly as we're predicting at $81 per barrel. The rule of thumb around the $81 per barrel is about $70 million of general fund revenue per dollar change in oil price. And the reason we're presenting this slide again was that in the slide last week, we had the horizontal and vertical line were misplaced on the slide. So this is a corrected version of that chart.
Okay, thank you.
And slide seven presents similar information in table form. This is taken from Appendix A1 of the Fall 2022 Revenue Sources Book, and shows what that unrestricted general fund revenue number would be for fiscal year 2024, 2025, and 2026 at a very wide range of oil prices. We've also provided a more detailed 10-year sensitivity analysis to the committee as a separate follow-up document.
Okay. Just for the department, years ago, this wasn't included in the revenue source book on the data. I think it's nice to have for the legislature. It's been in for a few years, so they grasp the sensitivity of it.
So moving on to slide eight, we had presented last week a chart showing a comparison of the spring 2022 and fall 2022 North Slope oil production forecasts. The chart last week started with a y-axis of zero and provided a 10-year outlook. What we were requested to do was to provide a more narrow y-axis and then a shorter outlook to really allow the committee and the public to understand the direction of the production forecast during the next 5 years, as well as how that forecast has changed from the spring forecast. And what we see here is the forecast is for slight increases in oil production. That said, the forecast has been reduced a little bit from the spring forecast, largely a function of the slightly lower oil price forecast, as well as some reevaluations by Department of Natural Resources about the timing of some of the new projects coming online, but still looking at increasing production over the next several years, which is great news.
Okay.
And then slide nine is the same information from the previous slide, providing the raw numbers for the committee's benefit. The next two slides look at capital and operating expenditures and how those break out between deductible and non-deductible expenses. So we start with these two slides. Slide 10 starts with capital expenditures. We start with allowable capital expenditures. These are all capital expenditures that are allowed to be deducted on the production tax calculation. Includes most, but not all of the company expenses for capital. And then we break these out into two components, which are we call deductible and non-deductible. This is not a statutory term. This is a term of art that we use. The deductible lease expenditures is that portion of allowable lease expenditures that is able to be applied by a company to offset gross revenue in the year incurred. And then non-deductible expenditures are any remaining expenditures above and beyond the gross revenue. Practically speaking, what this means is that deductible lease expenditures generally represent spending by incumbent producers that have existing production on the North Slope. Non-deductible expenditures generally represent spending by companies that are not existing producers or have very little existing production and are working on exploration and development. So we do see a major increase in capital expenditures are expected in the fiscal year 2023 through 2026 time horizon. And what the chart here shows is that a lot of that increase is attributable to non-deductible capital expenditures. This represents major investments in new fields by companies that are not current producers. This would be fields including PICA, but also other new developments.
And then touch on what happens to those non-deductible. Now yes, that works.
Mr. Chairman, so the deductible lease expenditures are used to are used as part of the current year tax calculation and impact current year tax revenues. Any of those non-deductible lease expenditures, those turn into a carried forward annual loss, and those can be used to offset future year tax calculation.
Senator Bishop.
On your last statement, is that there's a term, a timeline for that, isn't it 7 years?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, so for the carried forward lease expenditures, those lease expenditures, they can be carried forward indefinitely, beginning with the 8th or 11th year after the lease expenditure is earned. If they have not been used, there is a reduction. We call it a downlift, where those reduce in value by 10% for each year. So definitely beneficial to companies to get into production and use those lease expenditures quickly.
Thank you.
And could you touch on the time value of money on that also? You've got your downdraft after year 10 or so, but between time 0 and time 10, you have purchasing power eroding that also.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So if you were to adjust for the impacts of inflation or the cost of capital to a company, the real value of those lease expenditures is decreasing over time for the company, regardless of whether we have an uplift or downlift. And so then our downlift just further erodes the real value of those lease expenditures over time.
Right. So it's in the industry's best interest to use them sooner than later.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And I think when we go through the order of operations, there'll probably be questions on the forward-looking accumulation of those credits for deductibility and where they actually accumulate from. So we can cover that when that day comes here in a few days.
We'll be ready, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We'll go on to number 11.
So moving on to slide 11, this is a similar chart, but providing detail for operating expenditures. What you can see is the vast majority of operating expenditures are expected to be considered deductible expenditures. This is because most of the operating costs are the costs of operating units that are in current production. And then slide 12, we had presented a slide showing the history and forecast for allowable capital expenditures and operating expenditures. We'd also included an 11-year history of oil and gas employment, and we were asked to provide a forecast of oil and gas employment. So we reached out to the Department of Labor and their research and analysis section. They have a current year forecast for oil and gas employment. For 2023, that forecast is 7,400 jobs, and they have a 2030 forecast, which is 9,600 jobs. They don't have a year-by-year forecast for each of the years in between 2023 and 2030. So for illustrative purposes, we placed a dashed line in there to kind of show the general expected upward trajectory in oil and gas employment.
Thank you.
And that was the last slide I had in the tax division section of the responses. So if there's further questions, or I can hand over to Treasury.
I don't see any questions from you. Get off the hook today early.
All right. We'll see you in a couple days.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Adam Crum, Commissioner Designee for Revenue. I'd like to ask, I apologize. Moving on to Treasury now. Director Pam Leary. To come up and address the written responses. We don't have a slideshow for this, sir, so we'll be referring to the questions that we've submitted back in writing.
Okay.
Sorry. It's okay. For the record, this is Pam Leary. I'm the Treasury Director. I first would like to address one of the questions that came out of the revenue sources presentation, and that was related to fees for the Treasury-managed funds, so the state funds. And I provided a response of the total costs for managing non-arm board assets was $4 million. And based on an ending net asset value for fiscal year 2022, the value of these assets was $9.4 billion. And so our costs were approximately 4.2 basis points for those assets. This compares favorably to the fees that were mentioned in the revenue sources book for the ARM board, which was 38 basis points, and for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation of 57 basis points.
Okay.
In our separate presentation.
Just define basis points again for those that may be just tuning in today, and this is their first Finance Committee meeting.
So a basis point is 1/100 of 1%. It would be 0.01% or 0.0001 if you were using it to calculate on net assets. Mm-hmm. And it's a common denominator really that is used in the investment industry when talking about fees and costs as a percentage of total net assets. So referring to the response letter that seems very long. It's 7 pages of question and answers, and there are 2 attachments. This is in response to questions asked during the Savings Reserves and Investment Funds presentation last Monday. The first question was about the Power Cost Equalization Fund. And so we have attachment 1 on page 8 and 9, and it's showing 5 years of quarterly target and actual asset allocations, as well as quarterly performance compared to the benchmarks. And if you move to that slide, there are 5 sections. The first is the actual target of the asset allocations, and you can see how it changes generally from year to year on page 8.
You can just hold it a minute. We're fumbling around with these papers. We got to find where we're at. No, I have a brief at ease. back on the record. We've got quite a thick packet here, so it takes us a minute to grab them up, but we're talking about page 1 of 2 on attachment 1. Is that correct?
Chair Stedman, that is correct. And this is the savings, reserves, and investment funds response, which is different from the response that was previously presented for the revenue sources book. So we're looking at the 5 years of quarterly asset allocation targets, as well as the change in targets. So for example, in fiscal year 21, you can see that the fourth quarter had roughly a 60% fixed income to 40% equity asset allocation. And that changed in quarter one of fiscal year 22, where in the second band, you can see a 17% decrease in the asset allocation to core U.S. fixed income, and that went into equities. So the third grouping shows the actual asset allocations for that quarter, and the fourth grouping shows the relative asset allocation, so the actual compared to the target that was set. We've also provided quarterly returns, so you can see the information for both the plan return, its benchmark, and how it compares.
Yeah, it would have been nice to have it on the screen in front of us because this is for the public and they have no clue what we're talking about.
Apologies. Hopefully this is a document that will be up there that they can follow later. But noted for future presentations and answering questions. Mm-hmm. We've also provided in the first and second page of the response letter the 5 years of annual returns and their benchmark and how they compared for the year ending as of December, the calendar year. And we also are preparing information to present on power cost equalization in terms of the prospective return, risk, the impact of downside returns, and other scenarios using both 3-year and 5-year smoothing, and that should be ready fairly soon. And I believe the co-chairs requested to see the information so that we can decide what to present. So hopefully we can do that.
Yes, soon. We'll work with the department on that future presentation on PCE. That's a power cost equalization. Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
Yes.
Okay. So any other questions on paragraph or item number 1? The page, I guess. We'll go on then to number 2.
For item number 2, the question related to the restructuring and savings of the airport system debt. And the question was whether it extended the amortization period. And the answer is no. The restructuring reduced the future debt service payments from fiscal year 22 to 2036 without extending the amortization. And that was due in part to lower interest rates, but also there was a cash contribution of the airport system to make that savings occur.
Okay, and I hope those communities that are watching this or their lobbyists take note of that, where the state didn't extend the term, thereby getting our capital asset paid off. Not all communities around the state are doing that, and it is a concern. So thank you for that information. Number 3.
And the question for item 3 was whether any Jafonzi funds are having problems or doing really well. And for the most part, the Treasury manages the Jafonzi fund, the general fund and other non-segregated investments as one investment fund. And each fund that's allowed to receive earnings by statute, they get that on a daily basis. But we don't really analyze how the funds are doing within the Jafonzi unless we are approached by an agency with questions about the fund balance and earnings. The Division of Finance, the Office of Management and Budget, and Legislative Finance, they monitor most of the balances to ensure that funds are not over-appropriated. But we don't really have a look into all of the 185 funds that make up the Jafonzi funds.
And just for a note, we normally get a briefing from Ledge Finance every year, and we watch fund balances. They give us kind of red flags when fund balances appear to be perilous, or perilously low, I should say. So then we try to address it. The public doesn't normally see that. We don't normally have hearings on it, but both finance committees are well aware of that, and we kind of keep an eye on that to correct challenges before they become a mess. Okay, go on to the next question, I guess.
So item four was a question about how many other funds had asset allocations similar to the Higher Education Investment Fund, and there are five of them. They're the Power Cost Equalization Fund, the Public School Trust Fund, the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund, the Education Endowment Investment Fund, and the Illinois Creek Mine Reclamation Fund. All of the funds have the same underlying asset class building blocks, but they're not commingled at the fund level. They invest into each of the asset classes. They don't need to have the same asset allocations, but that was the targets that were set with the fiduciary for these particular funds. And that's something that occurs annually or more often as needed.
Okay. Seeing no questions on that, we'll go to number five.
Question five and six are linked. The question is, how exactly is the benchmark decided? Are we using the right ones, and which funds have missed the benchmarks? I've provided the benchmark that is being used for each of the asset classes in the state funds. A benchmark is essentially a portfolio of unmanaged securities that represent a market segment. Like, so for domestic equity, the benchmark that we have been using is the Russell 3000 Equity Index. And so they're known as indexes. They're very common for public assets. Others, like for small company stocks, you could use the Russell 2000, the S&P 600. Essentially, the benchmarks are picked after working with the fiduciary of the funds to make sure that they are the right benchmarks. And all of the benchmarks are subject to ongoing scrutiny by our compliance group, independent consultants, and investment advisors through the State Investment Review Board.
Okay, so give the committee a little bit more background on the Russell 3000. What is that? And who is Russell, and why is it 3,000 and not 150?
So there are common institutions that are known for index management. So like the S&P, you probably heard of, the Russell, MSCI, the Russell 3000. It's like essentially each benchmark has a segment of the market that it's looking at, whether it is the largest 3,000 or top 3,000 in Russell's index of the companies that are there. And so it's tracked on a daily basis as an index fund, and that's what we compare our assets to for domestic equity.
Okay, so it's what you're telling us is it's 3,000 of the largest funds by capitalization, most likely.
That's correct.
Number of stocks outstanding by price times price. The Russell has 1,000, an index that's 1,000. They have one that's 2,000. The next tier down, 2,000 after you take the 1,000 biggest ones off. And then the 3,000 is the top 3,000. It includes the 1,000 and 2,000. So it's the top 3,000 equities traded on the New York Stock Exchange and other stock exchanges. That's what you're wanting to tell us?
That's correct, Joe Sibman. And so we take that world of an index of funds, and we compare that to our equity investments. So our asset classes, we look to the benchmark that most looks like the funds that we're managing.
And I think that'll be helpful when we get into the asset allocation. Some folks in the building aren't going to be as familiar with this stuff as finance can. We look at it every year. So it's some of these questions are we're extracting from you is more informational. So But it is important that we understand what the benchmark actually is. And then we can, because we have a concern with power cost equalization, some of the members on the risk tolerances of the elected officials or here at the table may be different from the department. So we need to sort work that out as we go forward the next several months.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. And these asset classes that we have benchmarks for, all of those asset classes are used as kind of building blocks for the funds. So the funds invest in the asset classes. And so the benchmark for a particular fund would equal whatever percentage of asset allocation to each class we have. So for example, if we have like a 60% equity, 30% fixed income, and 10% cash invested fund, that asset allocation, we would compare to 60% of the equity benchmark, 30% of the fixed income benchmark, et cetera. So just to put that in context of the building blocks and then the funds, how they roll up.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Leary, I guess as you look at issues like missing the benchmark, do you have a tolerance that you have that in order to call it a missed benchmark point, or do you know what I mean? They're not all the benchmarks are going to be right on. It's impossible to go ahead and do. It's like trying to figure out what oil prices are. But if somebody misses the benchmark, how much do they have to miss it by before it goes into the missed category?
Senator Olson, through the chair, if you look at the attachment one, you can see the change in targets. So we, I think, have a 0.0001 tolerance. Like, so if it's slightly below, it will go into the negative category. It would be zero, and we round up to 1/100th of a percent when we show our targets. So if you look at the slide on the attachment, the attachment one, for the power cost equalization fund, you can see the relative in that fourth grouping, the relative to the actual target for fiscal year 23, quarter two. You can see that the core U.S. fixed income missed its benchmark, its target, by negative 1.3%.
And so is that does that fit into the category of a basis point as well? Is that what's measured?
Yes. If you translate these into basis points, you can look at it as basis points as well. We chose to use percentages here. Okay. And so you can see that in many of these quarters, we have asset allocations that miss their targets in terms of percentages, but a lot of them that do. And then when you look at returns, which is the final grouping on this page, you can see that there are plan returns and benchmark returns. And this is the returns, not the asset allocations I was talking about earlier. And you can see that those also fluctuate. Mm. The very last line shows the relative return. And in quarter four of fiscal year 22, you can see that the benchmark was missed by 0.10%.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you're looking at the asset classes on the question number five and then your designations on attachment one, are they, the terminology isn't the same, but are they the same? Like on the question, you have domestic equities, and on attachment one, it's broad domestic equities. And then you have global equities on attachment one. Does that equate to international equities? So your terminologies aren't the same, but can you explain why you have different terminologies? Are the same or aren't they the same?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, thank you for that question. They do equate, as you stated. So the domestic equity is the same as the broad domestic equity on the attachment. In the response to question five, I was just using general categories of asset classes, but they do equate, and the international equity does equate to the global equity line on the attachment.
And for the bonds as well?
That's correct. We have the core U.S. fixed income bonds and the high yield bonds, and those equate to the core U.S. fixed income benchmark that is listed in the response to the question.
Thanks for trying to confuse me.
So is there a difference between global equity and international equity?
Chair Stedman, there are, and there are different indexes. We are using global equity and the MSCI All Country World Index ex-US as our benchmark for that category.
Okay. They are different. Yes.
That is the one that we are using, right. The benchmark, and we are calling it global equity. But there are other benchmarks that could be used for international equity, if that's the question.
Okay. Any other questions on? Okay. Go on, I guess, now to question number six.
Which funds have missed the benchmark is question number six. We saw in attachment one that the power cost equalization fund did miss intermittently some of its return benchmarks. It is not common for always making the benchmarks. For the year ended December 31st, 2022, all of our asset classes did outperform for that year. They're in its partially a combination of investment skill and fortuitous cash flow timing. Money comes in and out of the funds, and sometimes it leads to positive and sometimes negative returns for different funds. The one fund that did not outperform during that period of time was the Jafonzi 2. And that was in part due to a higher level of cash because of cash transfers that had started at the beginning of the fiscal year. So a fortuitous cash event that did not go in the favor of that particular fund. I've also provided some snapshots of net pool performance. So the performance of the broad market fixed income pool, its benchmark, and also relative performance to the benchmark of that particular asset class. And so those are the building blocks that we use to then show the performance of the different funds using these combination of different asset classes.
Can we go back to the PCE attachment one, first page? Just got a question from the fourth quarter of 22 to the first quarter of 23, and we all know hindsight's 2020 in this business. Going forward is not quite 2020 vision, to say the least. But you have an allocation at 43% in fixed income, and then it goes up the next first quarter of 23 to 39.9% up from 32 on equities, 32 to 39 on equities, and then bonds dropping from 43, fixed income, 43 to 30. So when you do the allocation adjustments, is there any discussion on making those allocations slower or faster depending on market conditions at the time? And I don't have the market movements here on these quarters, but can you help me with that?
Chair Stedman, when asset allocation changes are made, we generally like to do it at the start of a quarter. And as markets will bear, we try to make them happen as soon as possible. I believe that in some cases, it takes a little bit longer to divest, but it's really done as soon after an asset allocation change is made, so that we are conforming to the discussions and signed off process that we go through, which is, again, a rigorous process that our portfolio team does in looking at the capital market assumptions, determining what asset allocation should be brought, working with consultants, and then bringing the asset allocations to the Commissioner of Revenue, in this case for the Power Cost Equalization Fund, and signing off on those asset allocations and putting them into motion as soon as possible.
So what triggered the allocation in the first quarter of 23, allocation adjustment?
So the change occurred based on the legislation that was passed last year, SB 243, which changed how this particular investment was managed more to the prudent investor rule, and that would and the goal was to maximize both income and appreciation. So the matching asset allocation results in a higher risk profile for the Power Cost Equalization Fund than had been. So it went from roughly a 44% bond, 56% equity fund to a 30%, 70%. So it increased the risk profile of this fund.
Okay, Senator Hoffman.
Change from what I know we discussed this at the last meeting that we discussed this. What was the prior investment rule before the prudent investment rule?
There, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the target at that point when the change was made was that the fund should achieve a 5% return target, which had been lowered from 7%. And so that target, when we look at the asset allocation and try to optimize what asset allocation would lead to a 5% return, that is a different one than trying to optimize it beyond. And I know that a lot of this information for power cost equalization specifically, we're preparing a slide deck that can be discussed more in depth so you can see the process and all the components of it, and we hope to have that shortly.
Okay, and when you do that, could you take a look at the fourth quarter to first quarter of 21 to 22? We see a equity allocation increase from roughly 24% to 32%. So there's an increase there, and then there's a step up in fourth quarter to first quarter of 22 to quarter 23, there's an increase from roughly 30% up to 40. So we can go over those two steps on the equity allocation, which is the more volatile one, and then we can go through that. So we're just not isolating the one step when you do that presentation, if you can do that.
Absolutely, we can do that. And the changes result because of the annual asset allocation discussion and what the markets are doing and how to optimize mm-hmm. for every particular year that we look at setting asset allocations. So it's a result of that process, all of the changes that you see occurring from the fourth quarter of a particular fiscal year to the first quarter of the next.
Senator Hoffman.
And then can you give the committee and the listening audience an idea of the comparison of the prudent investment rule for the Power Cost Equalization Fund to the, if it's possible, given these different seven categories, what the investment rules are for the permanent fund.
Sure, we can do that in the presentation.
Thank you.
Any other questions on this? We'll, and then when we do that, we'll have the benchmarks or the market returns with it also. We'll watch the portfolio and the returns. And again, just for those watching at home, hindsight's 2020 in this business. So we're not
you know, that's not the point of the discussions. We need to have a thorough understanding of the mechanics of the committee. So if we recommend some allocation or some risk tolerance changes, because you guys do the allocation, but if we have a risk tolerance adjustment, the legislature, for you to consider that it's well-founded. That's the impetus, I guess, for the information.
One other question. Yes. Go, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Going back to number four, where you say the allocations for the higher education fund, the power cost equalization fund, the school trust fund, are all of these categories in the prudent investment rule? And when did the other ones, if that's true, when did the other funds get into the criteria of the prudent investment rule?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the prudent investor rule is a rule that the Commissioner of Revenue adheres to when reviewing and setting asset allocations for these funds. Most of these funds have a very long-term horizon and therefore have the capability, because they're not used, their liquidation pattern is such that they're going to have money for quite a long time as it's spent down. And so the risk allocation is high. And so we have all five of these funds that are targeted for that higher risk allocation.
And are they, are the rest of them set by law, as we did with the power cost equalization fund last year?
Through the chair, I'm not sure that all of them have the specific language in the funds, but I can get back to you on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So to kind of put that in, try to put that in English, the prudent investor rule, can you summarize that? Or do you want some help?
The prudent investor rule is written in statute. I'm going to have some help on the exact definition, but it is essentially what a prudent investor would invest a particular fund, considering what its liquidity is and the type of fund it is and what it is intended to be used for.
So let's try to put it in context for those folks watching at home trying to figure out what we're talking about. Years ago, there was a case, and it's on everybody's coffee cup here. It's the prudent man rule, and I'll read it. All that can be required of a trustee to invest is that he shall conduct himself faithfully and exercise a sound discretion. He is to observe how men of prudence, discretion, and intelligence manage their own affairs, not in regard to speculation, but in regard to the permanent disposition of their funds, considering the probable income as well as probable safety of the capital to be invested. Samuel Putnam, and this goes back a couple hundred years. How a average man, women nowadays, but this was written 200 years ago or so, would run their affairs. And the and what we're talking about here is a professional investor, how they would run their affairs, which is different than the man on the street. And they would run their financial affairs as other professionals in the field would run their affairs and their allocation, and that's where we fall into a lot of the benchmark. We were talking about, you beat the benchmark, even if the benchmark goes negative, and you beat the benchmark, that's still good. Where a common man might have a coronary right at the table because of the negative loss or some indigestion. So there is a difference, and it's, sometimes we get wrapped up in the gobbledygook of what we're trying to talk about, but that's basically what we're talking about here, how professionals would manage their portfolios versus the common man. And all of the committee members that have been on the committee have it, and the staff has this imprinted on their coffee cup as a reminder that we're not professional investors, and we want to, you know, have prudence and discretion of how we handle the affairs of the state and the people's purse.
So we've got to bridge that gap, and we'll work on that with the presentation coming.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. And it is in statute that the fiduciary should be managing the funds according to the prudent investor rule. So right. We will outline that as well.
Yep.
And give some history. But essentially, it is our job as fiduciaries, the commissioner as fiduciary, the Iron Board as fiduciary, to manage the funds in a manner that somebody of professional background would as an investor.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
Understanding all of that, but the why we're here today going over this is Senator Olson and I and others at the table, but we're the ones that are probably most affected by the investments of the Power Cost Equalization Fund. And the first year that we switch over to the prudent investment rule, however prudent that was, we saw a 20% loss or $200 million loss in the purchasing power or the net of the Power Cost Equalization Fund, which is, to me, quite astonishing.
Right. And that's where the earlier comment was that the risk tolerances of some of the members are not lining up with the risk tolerance of the portfolio. I think that's the issue. So we'll work through that, and 200 million, it's a lot of money, even if you say it fast. So, okay, we'll go on to the next question, I guess.
Item 7 was a request to provide a copy of the cash efficiency memorandum of understanding, and it's essentially a cash efficiency plan. That is the second attachment that you have. The one that we have is the most recent, updated as of 2017. It essentially talks about the $400 million balance that we discussed in the initial presentation as being our cash baseline requirement in order to manage the ongoing day-to-day operations of the state. It was developed in the 1990s by the Departments of Law, Revenue, and Administration, as well as the Office of Management and Budget, and it is reviewed annually to see if updates are required. I'm happy to answer any questions if anybody has any on attachment two.
I think the concern here is on the cash deficiency. One, we don't run into it. We have minimum balances. I think we're targeting $500 million to float the state. And for some of us, we're not comfortable with going to the permanent fund, spending the $500 million and then going to the permanent fund and cash flow the state. So it's good to be aware of the cash deficiency plan. But our goal here is to not be deficient in cash. Number 8, please.
Question 8 asked what the timing of the call for the POMV disbursement is for the ERA. For fiscal year 23, $1.68 billion was transferred to pay dividends in the beginning of July 2022. And the remaining $1.68 billion will be transferred to the general fund during the second half of this fiscal year, which is dependent on when the transfers will occur from the general fund to the CBR. For fiscal year 2024, the POMV draw is going to be $3.52 billion. The governor's budget reflects $2.47 billion to be used to pay dividends, and that would leave a little over $1 billion for operations. And then the timing of when that will occur will again depend on cash projections as the new fiscal year approaches, as oil revenue and other revenues are forecasted, and we look towards what our expenditures are.
Okay. Have any questions on the timing? And we'll talk with the permanent fund about that too. We'll have them go over that when they're here and how they handle it. Sometimes they look at things a little different than than we do, of course, because they have different goals and objectives. But okay, we'll go on then to question number nine.
Question nine, we were asked to identify what the 14 defined benefit funds were, and we've listed them there in the packet. They are primarily consisting of the defined benefit pension trust and health trust of the public employees retirement system, the teachers retirement systems, judicial retirement systems, and National Guard and Naval Militia retirement systems. There are a handful of other funds within each of the systems that are part of the defined contribution plans, but they are invested alongside the other pension and healthcare trusts in terms of an asset allocation and are considered defined benefit components of the defined contribution plans.
So you're referring to, I think, then the old legislative pension that was in place for 1 year, maybe 30 years ago?
Chair Stedman, these are more like the occupational death and disability funds for PERS and the retiree medical plan. And I know that these are the subject of the presentation that the Division of Retirement and Benefit will provide.
Right. So we'll bring that up with the when we do our PERS and TERS review. But there is a separate retirement plan for the legislatures that were in place maybe 40 years ago. There's a couple little ones, so we'll make sure that they're either included in this or a separate line, so we can keep an eye on that also. Any other questions on this before? And the Department of Revenue through Retirement and Benefits is preparing a presentation for the committee to look at the current status of the existing newer tiers, tier four for PERS, tier three for TERS, relative to where the earlier tier was. If it's tier three for PERS, replaced the defined benefit, replaced with a defined contribution, how they compare against each other. So that when they get that work done in the next few weeks, then we'll schedule in here at the committee, and there'll be a presentation, and it'll probably be like this. We'll have a bunch of questions or whatever, and then we'll get those questions answered. But we'll try to get a feel for what is actually the performance of those tiers, good, bad, or otherwise. And if it's, then we'll go from there if we got problems or what have you. So we'll need some of those component parts separated. And just for those watching, we've asked them to separate out the communities that are involved in PERS that are not included in Social Security and SBS. There'll be a separate category. Police and fire will be, I think, a separate category because they're under 20 years groups. And so we're trying to compartmentalize it so it's meaningful presentation, not just a big aggregate numbers where, you know, there's different component parts with different time frames in it. So we'll await the department's analysis and get it up on the table as soon as we can. We're going to, I guess, you know, questions, we're going to question 10.
Item 10, we were asked to provide the breakdown of the $1.37 billion balance. That was on one of our slides, and that was composed of $910 million of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund and $410 million for the Statutory Budget Fund. Again, those were cash balances. And further discussion, when I listened to the hearing, there was a request about the accrued balances. And based on discussions with Division of Finance and Office of Management and Budget, the accrued balance as of that same date, June 30th, 2022, is estimated to be $2.2 billion, and that's resulting from the general fund transfers to the CBRF for fund surpluses and sweep amounts. And the SBR is expected to have $370 million in it.
Okay. And sometimes we hear a lot of different numbers because we use projections in our budgets, and that is different than actual cash balances. So we'll put a finer light on that as we go through and work on the budget.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Adam Crum, Commissioner Designee, Department of Revenue. For question number 11, we're asked to provide a minimum balance or range for the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. This is an item which OMB is going to be prepared to respond to when they come up after us, sir.
That's fine.
And then if we can move to question number 12, it's about the how credit rating agencies view a $500 million CBRF balance. And so rating agencies do view the state credit rating profile as unique compared to other United States, compared to other states within the U.S. due to our economic concentration and dependence on volatile oil and gas commodity pricing. So that being said, our rating agencies have viewed the state's rating outlook as stable and positive due to the financial standing, was in our low debt profile, our reduction in pension obligations, and other post-employment benefits obligations, including our sizable constitutional budget reserve. And so that's where we're at is the conversations we're having with our credit rating agencies. We are looking up because we have been paying down long-term debt over time.
And I think our pension obligation increased about $1 billion, but that's market conditions. That'll be across the country, so we're not alone in that. So we'll try to ensure that we have $500 million so you can make payroll. Any other questions on? And just one quick note before, because I think that pretty much concludes your presentation, then we'll go into OMB. This does not include the cushion that we need to insulate ourselves from fluctuating oil prices. $500 million is just to make payroll and make the system run. Just to make sure we bifurcate those two issues. Okay, I guess we'll let you off the hook. Good job. Thanks for answering the questions. I know it's, you know, you're just enthusiastic about coming to the finance table. We look forward to the PCE discussion. We'll work with you on that. Clearly, there's the prudent investor rule, and then there's the risk tolerance of the customer or the client. We're kind of the client, so we'll work through that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have Mr. Neil Steininger, Director of the OMB. He's been waiting all morning.
Good morning. For the record, Neil Steininger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. And the committee should have a letter with responses to questions asked of me on January 24th. And with the will of the chair, I might, if I could, kind of go a little bit out of order and ask Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills to come up to address a question a little bit later in the packet, just because she has another meeting to get to here in a little bit.
Okay, we're going to take a brief at ease because we've got to sort out our stack of papers. We'll have a brief at ease. come back on the record. We're running short of time today, and we're going to kind of go out of order. We're going to let the Deputy Attorney General, Ms. Corey Mills, jump to her part of the questions so she doesn't have to come back. Mr. Steininger likes the Finance Committee so much, he volunteered to come back as soon as we can get him in front of us again. So go ahead, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Steadman. Again, for the record, Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills for the Civil Division of the Department of Law. I'm here to address a question that came up, I believe, from Senator Olson in particular about our statehood defense cases. And just to remind the committee and the public, over the past 2 years, the legislature has graciously appropriated money, a multi-year funding source for us, because we've been seeing a great increase in cases involving federal issues, specifically cases involving states' rights, as well as our statehood land management and what belongs to the state versus what belongs to the federal government. So in answer to that question, I believe it was relating to what's kind of the rate of success in those cases. When it comes to the cases that that particular appropriation has been used for, that multi-year appropriation that I discussed, at this point, we don't have any final decisions. We either have cases that were at the district court and now on appeal. We have cases that had preliminary injunctions, but we don't have final cases. So from an overall perspective, they're all still pending. But to kind of drill down a little bit further, I did look at the cases. We have four cases out of the 14 that you'll find on the list, and at the back of your packet should be a document entitled Multi-Year Statehood Defense States' Rights Funding. These are all the current cases that are being funded with that source of funding. And four of those 14 cases were lost at the district court level and are now on appeal. The remainder, like I said, are pending at this point. The other one that's had some action is the 40 Mile Rivers Quiet Title Action. So this is part of our Navigability Unlocking Alaska initiative. The federal government actually disclaimed 90% of those rivers that we had brought the lawsuit on. So we're now down to 10% in that case that we're now litigating over. So that was a positive action in that case that kind of reduced that case to a much smaller amount. But the remainder of these cases are all still ongoing, but I'll provide updates as we get them.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mills, thank you very much for coming in this morning. It's certainly an issue that is people are passionate about, especially we just had the guides in yesterday, and it looks like an uphill struggle for them. But the question I have is that as you go forward, what's the percentage of decisions made where you've lost at the district level, lost at the appellate level, that you're going to go for certiorari for the Supreme Court? Do you have that number?
Yes, Senator Olson, through the chair, I don't have those numbers with me. Like I said, we have four that were definitely on appeal, and that's three of those are at the appeals court. One of those we just asked for certiorari for the U.S. Supreme Court, and that is the Kenai Refuge Rule case. And we just got responses yesterday, and our reply will be due, I think, in 14 days. So we could hear as soon as 2 weeks from now whether the U.S. Supreme Court is going to take up that issue. That case deals with whether the state or the federal government, who has the ability to set forth the means and methods of hunting. So it doesn't have to do with closures or when you open and who gets to hunt where. It's about whether the state has sole control over methods and means or whether the federal government also has authority there. Of course, our position is the state has that control. So that's the issue that we're hoping to get the U.S. Supreme Court to take up.
And Mr. Chairman, I can continue. And the chance of success of cert coming out of that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that I feel like I'm looking into a crystal ball. Your chances when it's a state asking always goes up. But again, the U.S. Supreme Court does take a very small percentage. I can't remember what it is right now, but it's a, you know, I think 20% is even a high number. So you're always kind of facing an uphill battle when asking for certiorari. I will say we were able to get a number of states to support us. So we got an amicus brief from, I think, 10 other states filing, which shows the importance of the issue on a broader scale. And so we're hoping that that brings us across the finish line. But of course, it's the chances are always lower when you're looking at the U.S. Supreme Court granting review.
Last question, Mr. Chairman. Has to do with, as you look at the Supreme Court, the makeup of the Supreme Court, which is fairly conservative after the last appointees came on through, you're still down only at 20%. I would expect it would be higher because the appellate courts certainly seem to be more liberal than the Supreme Court does. But, you know, it's a decision made by the Department of Law.
Yeah, Senator Olson, through the chair, I think you're making a really good point. We just haven't seen that borne out yet. Mm-hmm. We have to wait to kind of see what the court's doing over the next couple years and how many cases it takes on. We had success last summer with West Virginia versus EPA. That's a case the state of Alaska was on as well that kind of got the major questions doctrine more defined. And that's something we're definitely utilizing in more of our cases. So I think our chances have gone up with this court. I'm just waiting to see how those statistics bear out in the next couple of years.
Senator Hoffman.
Last comment, Mr. Chairman. This is a very important case because it has to do with predator control and even local people in different parts of the state, whether they can go ahead and have a handle in predator control. So it's a very important issue. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman and Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this particular case that is being appealed to the Supreme Court, what is the cost related to that?
So let me look at my sheet. The Kenai Refuge Rule, we estimate that at about $150,000 to kind of take it across the finish line. And that's from kind of the appeal level since this was a case that was kind of already in progress. But $150,000 is the estimate.
The question that I have is, why ask for the funds now if your success rate is at 20%? Why not ask for a supplemental if in fact you are successful?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, so I want to clarify the question was really about the chances of getting the U.S. Supreme Court to grant a case. So I just want to be clear that our success rate on all the cases as a whole isn't 20%. In fact, we don't really know that yet, although our navigability cases have generally, I don't know of a navigability case we have lost yet. So I expect actually a lot of success on those cases. So, but your question in terms of the money, first of all, it's hard to predict when a case is going to all of a sudden cost a lot of money. For example, even at the Supreme Court level, if you get cert granted, then you have a bunch of briefing that you're going to have to do and you have oral argument. We don't know when the court is going to specify that time. On the other cases, when you're dealing with the district court level, you have discovery, you're going back and forth with depositions. And again, we just never know when that's going to take off, when it's going to be lowered. It kind of depends on how the other party acts, what requests they make. So in terms of litigation, and we've seen this with like BP Corrosion back in the day, Flint Hills, it can be really hard to come back and for supplementals every year when you never know what's going to happen in the interim. But we are trying to keep track of that and at least make you aware of what we anticipate costs could be over time. But when those costs are due is really difficult to predict.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
With the time, what it is, I'll ask my question of law offline. Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Helpful to see this list of price tags on some of these multi-year authorizations. There's another document of 43 pages of cases. Are we able to get approximate price tags on those two? Because I noticed the multi-year appropriation one said we only come to this when we run out of the other money.
Through the chair, Senator Keel. So first of all, I'll clarify that when it says cases that have historical funding sources will default to the multi-year, that should clarify that it's only certain cases that really fit within the appropriation. For example, I believe there was a limitation on not using the money for subsistence-related cases, so we would never go to the multi-year for those cases. So I just want to be clear that it's not every case in this list. But in terms of getting an estimate, we can go through, and it's really our estimates are based. It's really hard to estimate case costs. But what we did is went back and looked at, okay, similar types of cases. Is it an Administrative Procedure Act case that doesn't take as much discovery? Is it a case that's big in discovery? What are the average costs of those cases? That's how we came up with this list. And we could go through and do something similar for this list. And there's 47 cases on this list. Not all of them are natural resources cases either, which is what we tend to use the multi-year for. This is all the cases that involve federal issues that we are involved in.
Any other questions? Just have one. So the dealing with state of defense, sometimes state of defense is viewed from many angles, one of which is we have a lot of our historic artifacts removed from the state and sitting in museums and private collections in St. Petersburg, Russia, things like that. So could we include assistance in retrieving some of our artifacts, family artifacts, back to the state with state of defense?
Chair Stedman, I'm trying to recall the language of the appropriation. I think it is fairly broad, protecting our natural resources, reserving our right to responsible resource development. And I think there's a general kind of catch-all of, protecting our state's rights. So I just want to go back and look at that specific language. If it's the intent of the legislature, of course, that helps us know what our guidelines are. But we just always want to be careful that we're using it in the way the appropriation was intended.
Right, but there's a newer appropriation requested, isn't there, coming for $10
million? Chair Simon, that is correct, yes.
Yes, so it would be more of a future question than a previous question. So.
Oh, perfect.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There has been a change in direction on whether the funds should be included in the operating budget. This year they're being asked for in the capital budget. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, that is correct.
And as the chairman of the capital budget, I feel that the operating budget may be a better approach where they can review the cases and get into the specifics of the request much better than I, as the chairman of the capital budget. The other problem that I have with funding it in the capital budget has a life of potentially 6 years, and there can be automatic passage of unspent funds to the to be kept in that category, and I feel that reviewing it on an annual basis, the total amount would be better done by the operating budget. So I believe that, unless convinced otherwise, I would, for the purpose of scrutiny of the request, be supportive of keeping the appropriation in the operating budget, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I'll take good care of it, Senator Hoffman, with consultation from my committee members. Any other questions today? We're out of time. We'll have OMB come back, hopefully at the beginning of the next meeting, to finish up. If it doesn't work in the schedule, Ms. Steiner, we'll get with you and work with your schedule and our schedule so we can have the data in front of us. We appreciate all the departments coming forward today in their presentations and helping answer the questions and concerns of committee members. So that concludes today's meeting. The next meeting is tomorrow, 9 a.m. We're going to potentially start off with Mr. Steiner. And we're going to have an update on state debt and credit ratings. So we'll try to finish up today's, do tomorrow's, be back on schedule by 11 a.m. tomorrow. And we are adjourned at 11:02 a.m. We are adjourned.